This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The degradation of workers in the 21st century.
Well, in my neck of the woods, the jobless rate keeps falling, and the number of workers with decent jobs, but we're going to get into that because we have somebody who has both written a book and, very, very rare, not only is he a great writer, but he's a great lyricist and singer, and that is Tom Jurevich, and we'll tell you more about him. But first, we're going to hear one of his pieces of music as a segue into the overall interview, and let's do that right now.
I grew up at a time when a man could make his own fate by the sweat of his brow, by the work he'd do, by what his hands could make. Now my life hangs in the balance, deals brokered, made in sand. Far from this town, fate is sealed at the altar of the bottom line. I should have seen it coming. How was I supposed to know? The record production coming out of the plant, past 3 years in a row. And they bought that place in New Hampshire, wasn't much of a find. What are we workers supposed to know about the altar of the bottom line? Though their debt kept rising, still they were not afraid. They built a series of overseas plants using the machines we made. But as greed it blinded all reason, startup fell way behind time. But next quarter they'd have to ante up at the altar of the bottom line.
Well, I'm not sure we've reached the altar of the bottom line yet, because workers continue to be degraded as such, and, of course, the quality of work in our work lives, at least in my adult life, and I don't care what profession you're in, is worsening significantly. But somebody who's really thought about and really studied this and has a lot to tell us in an absolutely gorgeous written book is Tom Jurevich.
And Tom channels these workers' voices to provide a vivid account of the multiple challenges presented in today's workplaces. Now, Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies and author of At the Altar of the Bottom Line, and accomplished musician, as you've heard.
Indeed, and he takes a look at nurses at the Boston Medical Center and Verizon workers at a call center and immigrant workers in a processing and industry processing plant, fish processing. But hey, Tom, it's nice to hear from you.
Oh, so good to be with you, Mimi and Ken.
You're such a good storyteller.
Thank you.
And you're such a rarity, because aside from, which was really not my cup of tea as much, and that was Nickeled and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich. I've never been in this, let's work in a particular industry for a day or two or three or four and then kind of give a sense of what it's like. You really tell stories about workers and capture their voices and their sentiments, and you do it beautifully in your book.
Thank you, Mimi. That was the whole goal, you know. I could have written about this economic crisis. I could have written about the degradation of work from sitting in my office in Amherst or going on the Google, as one of my elderly neighbors calls it. But I really felt like I needed to get out and really speak with workers. And I spent over 6 years speaking to 85 different workers, and most of those interviews were an hour, 90 minutes, 2 hours long. And it's only when you really give workers a chance to speak that you really get those detailed kinds of stories. And you know, the hardest thing for me was to call it quits, because it was just such fascinating difficult, hard, but empowering work.
Well, what impressed me also is that a lot of people are saying we need to have jobs, we need to get the jobs back, but they're not talking about what jobs, how they well they pay, and also what people do when they're at work. And we shouldn't be lowering our expectations in this economic crisis.
Oh, absolutely, Ken. You know, it's really so seductive in this kind of economy to say, if you've got a job, then you shouldn't complain. But I think what this book documents is what's really going on, as Mimi started off this interview tonight with, is what's really happened to work over the past decade, over the past 5 or 6 years. You know, work has really been sped up. People are incredibly stressed. They're incredibly exhausted. And I think that in some ways, like the lobster in the pot with the water, you know, heating up gradually, we haven't really underscored and brought this to the public attention enough. There's so many changes that have happened at work, and I think we've got to also talk about a good jobs agenda, not just a jobs agenda.
Before we get into some of the specific industries that you look at and some of the stories, which must have been enormously hard to choose from, why? What is, you know, your lobster in the pot is a terribly frightening example. We become anesthetized. Give us more than that. Why are we so undemanding, in a manner of speaking, as a society, the working class itself, the individual worker, as to what should be the expectation, the benefit, the privilege from the work that we do and the wealth that we create for this society?
Yeah, it's so important. You know, I go back to 1912 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, you know, where the women struck not just for bread but for roses too. Sure, they wanted the wages to be able to feed their families and pay their rent, but they wanted more. They wanted some dignity and respect and some time to have a life and to live a life in their family and communities. And I think this is what we're really beginning to see disappear. And I think that, you know, we saw it over this last decade as working class incomes really stagnated. And the way that families made up for that is that more family members worked or people worked longer hours. And I think this has contributed to this sort of sense of what's going on. I think the other thing that's happened is that there's been a whole lot of insecurity out there. And as Michael Moore, you know, so much talks about the power of fear, I think that's what's going on for a lot of workers, is that they're almost afraid to talk about it. And I think this is one of the things why this show is so important, and hopefully this book is too, is to bring the secret out from the homes that people live in where they're struggling with these difficulties and the workplaces, and really bring this a part of a public discussion about the kind of jobs that we should have in this country and how important it is to have jobs with bread and roses.
Well, two of the jobs that you talk about are calling center jobs and nursing jobs, both of which are, by a lot of standards, good-paying jobs, but you talk about a dimension of those jobs that is not terribly visible to a lot of people, and that is the kind of stress and the kind of transformation that's been going on there. So why don't we focus on these jobs, which is the kind of jobs that in many cases we don't talk about because they are high-paying jobs.
Absolutely. And if you simply look at the wages or benefits, you say these are good jobs. But what's happened in this economy is there's been this big disconnect, this paradox, if you will, of the modern workplace between jobs that pay well and jobs that are good jobs. I mean, we used to see in the post-war economy large firms like Verizon, you know, major Fortune 500 firms, paid their people well and treated them pretty well. Now we see this big disconnect. And just to give you a couple of examples, you know, would we have expected in the 21st century that someone working for a Fortune 500 company would have to raise their hand to go to the bathroom, which is what they need to do at Verizon? Would we imagine that they were monitored throughout their entire shift, that they were forced to work mandatory overtime up to 10 hours a week, that if they took a sick day, they were disciplined for that sick day? These are unbelievable things that we don't associate with high-paying jobs. In Boston Medical, again, this was used to be a public hospital, Boston City Hospital, that served the working class and poor of Boston. When the hospital merged with the university hospital, they began to bring in tons more elective surgery to enhance the revenue of the hospital, with no increases of nurses. And nurses are working an incredible number of hours. They're exhausted, they're worn out, they're sick, they get sick. And as one nurse told me, we have regulations about how long you can drive a truck in America, but we don't have any regulations on how long you can be on the floor as a nurse dispensing medications that could make you live or could kill you. And these are the parts of these jobs that, you're right, we don't see, but for the workers themselves, it's not about the money. These are the things which, in nursing, have driven hundreds of thousands of nurses out of that profession. That's in part where that nursing shortage comes from. People are not willing to work for those in those kind of working conditions.
So it's stress, it's speed up, and, of course, it is a lessening of concern for the individual consumer of whatever the particular product is, whether it's health care that should be dispensed or if it's indeed a call center service capacity. I'm also interested in, by the way, just another example that you look at, and that is it was a fish processing plant, which was Guatemalan immigrants. But we remember a time, or I remember in school reading Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, and the increase in possibility and the recognition by society, both for consumers and workers, that there had to be something done with the meatpacking industry. We've gone backward. Why?
We've gone backward. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, fish processing is a lot like meat packing. And up until the early 1980s, it was an industry that became unionized. They became safe jobs. They became pretty good paying jobs with decent benefits. And in the 1980s, employers decided to deunionize these jobs. And in New Bedford, without the union, these wages plummeted. Safety and health conditions plummeted. And in some ways, you know, these jobs fell right out of the bottom of the U.S. labor market. Nobody would take this job if they had a job anywhere else. And then they attracted undocumented workers. And I think this is so important for our listeners to remember, you know, because the right wing oftentimes talk about how immigrant workers take jobs away from Americans. Well, they didn't take any jobs away from anybody. These were jobs that employers made worse to attract these kinds of low-wage workers. And this was an employer decision. And I think the thing we also need to remember is that as long as these workers are working under these conditions, which are right out of Upton Sinclair, that it lowers the floor for all American workers.
And, of course, things got worse for the immigrants after the raids. It wasn't just that they were exploited in these fish processing plants, but now they're not even in the plants. They're in the underground economy. Do you want to expand on that?
Absolutely. Again, you know, there are people in this country who think that we could somehow surgically remove 10 to 20 million undocumented workers and it would somehow make the country better. What happened in New Bedford was, first off, when they tried to, when they took almost 300 workers in hostage, what got left behind were 200 children, young children, many of them American citizens, and they created what the late Senator Kennedy called a humanitarian crisis in New Bedford. But beyond that, workers then were fired from their fairly decent jobs, I mean, jobs that we've already described aren't very good, but they were then driven further down in the economy, in the underground economy, where there was even less protections for them. And again, this doesn't help out either undocumented workers or the rest of Americans. So this practice has really amounted to little more than political theater, a lot like, you know, drug raids, which sometimes uses political people use to demonstrate their will, but does it significantly make a difference? No.
Tom, what do you consider the correlation between the really decimation of the organized labor movement, its lack of growth and development in so far as the impact on the quality of our work lives?
Oh, I think you have hit the nail on the head, Mimi. I mean, I think we need to remember that no job by definition is a good job or a bad job. Auto worker jobs in the 1930s were among the worst jobs in the country, and they were made better by organizing. And it's in that collective strength that jobs are made better. And I think that the whole degradation of work that we're feeling right now, not just me or the people I interviewed, I think across the country people are feeling this. That's a product of the fact of lack of organization. And even in those places where we have unions, like in Verizon, for example, this is a unionized shop, but with globalization, the pull of outsourcing, of sending those jobs overseas, is so powerful and so strong that it's really, really working to undermine organizing and organized labor. So I think the real key is, again, is to remember our history and the power of unions and the power of organizing to improve the nature of work. That's, I think, at the core of where the labor movement needs to be right now.
And you've done a lot of work on organizing workers, on what conditions they are best organized with and what kinds of environment produces organizability. Do you want to tell us, is it just the legislation that's in Washington right now that'll produce more workers in unions, or is there something else that we should be looking at?
You're talking about the Employee Free Choice
Act?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do we need to get a labor movement going again and organizing again?
Well, undoubtedly, the Employer Free Choice Act would, in fact, make organizing easier for workers. But I think the other thing that we need to remember, if we look back again to our own history, if we look at the 1930s and early 40s when we saw the passage of a lot of powerful labor legislation, it didn't come prior to organizing. It came as a result of organizing. So, you know, on the one hand, we could sit back and wait for legislation to happen, but I think our history really shows us that it's really being out there doing the work, doing the organizing work, that's going to change what happens in Washington, what happens in Albany, what happens around the states in this country. So legislation will be helpful, and if we can get it, it would be wonderful, but I don't think it's the only solution here. And I think what the organizing numbers tell us is that there is a lot of enthusiasm for unions out there, despite the high level of employer opposition. And we see a lot of support for unions among young people, among people of color, of people in non-traditional occupations. So I think that this is just a time where we have to dig in as a labor movement and get out there and continue to do the hard work of meeting members one-on-one, focusing on what matters to them, which is what happens at work, and building a movement that's based on justice and dignity and in some sense of trying to make this a better world for everybody.
Now, not only does at the altar of the bottom line the degradation of work in the 21st century come with a record, and how many books do, a fabulous CD, but I must tell you, you really need to read it. It is a beautiful book. It is a piece of art, and that I think is because it's told in a lyrical manner, just as Tom sings and thinks, and he has that musician's creativity that he brings to the writing. Every beat, every note is just a beautiful composition, and I really do want to encourage our listeners to get At the Altar of the Bottom Line, the Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. And Tom, I'd like you to tell us which of your many beautiful songs we should go out with. Again, it's just an example of some of the highlights and wonders that are in this excellent book that is for and about workers and the working class.
Well, maybe a great song to go out on is the song called Immigrants Like Me. And it's a song I wrote for the undocumented workers based on their words. And so much they told me that, you know, that we just want to keep immigrants in the shadows.
I was going to pick that one. Thank you. Well, we're going to do that. And that is number two. And, Tom, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Continue to do all the good work that you do and uplift the heroism, really, of the working class from which all wealth generates.
Mimi, thank you so much, and Ken, too. It's been a real pleasure to be with you.
Keep on producing those books and those CDs.
Okay, take care now.
You see us in the morning, out of the shadow, workers who look a lot like me. Work in the back rooms, the kitchens and the laundries, the places you don't see. We do the work nobody wants to. They have a better place to be. Oh, you just want us hidden in the shadows, in the place you made for immigrants like me. To make money, send home to our families. From our journeys, we've got debts to pay. So we work where we have to. We do what we need to make it.
And that was just another cut by Tom Jurevich from Altar of the Bottom Line, the CD and book.
and now for something completely different, an alternative to the degradation of work in the 21st century, an excerpt from Michael Moore's new DVD, Capitalism, A Love Story. Commie taxi drivers, you talking to me? Michael Moore investigates Union Cab, a cooperative taxi drivers union in Madison, Wisconsin.
I don't know much about politics. All I know is that we just need a good hard rain to wash the scum off the streets. I've been at Unicab for 21 years, and I wouldn't have stayed around this long if it weren't for our structure. We have an institutionalized system of seniority pay increases. So you get an extra percentage point every 2,500 hours that you work. So 21 years in, I'm making 50% commission. That's unheard of in this industry. And we have people making even more than that.
I have a PhD without the dissertation in anthropology, so I love observing people's behavior. The first 10 minutes I was in a cab, I thought, what have I been doing wasting my life not driving a cab? A workers' cooperative means the workers own the means of production. At Union Cab, we collectively share the risk, the economic risk. I work weekend nights, and I can expect to make between $18 and $26 an hour. The part of the meter that is not commission goes back to the co-op to pay for salaries of office workers, as well as for reinvesting in the company. We take the long-term view. We are the most successful cab company in the city of Madison. We do really, really well. And part of it may be that we aren't working to pay the CEO a six-figure salary. Our mission is to create jobs at a living wage. We are all one. I mean, our name, Union Cab, I think is beautifully evocative of how we are as a company. So we have Republicans, we have Democrats, we have socialists, we have anarchists, we have, I don't think we have any communists. And the thing we all agree on is our mission and our values. Can hold any political beliefs and still agree on that. You know, unlike some employee-owned companies, this is actual radical workplace democracy where everyone not only owns one share of the business, but also has a say in how the place is run. We get a lot of walking wounded from corporate America coming in, and they can't believe that workers have so much say in the quality of their work environment. We do have an information systems department.
Union Cab, this is Brad. Okay.
That is awesome, and you did this yourself.
Yeah.
I could actually dispatch now.
Yeah, that's the whole point. It's dispatching for dummies.
You really should sell this. You could make a fortune.
We.
Yeah. We could make a fortune.
This place, you're building towards something. And, you know, at the end of the year, if you have a good year, you get something back. We're kind of one of the older cooperatives in the area. We've been around since the late 70s, and we've been around here for quite some time. We'll be turning 30 in October this year.
So hopefully it'll be with the same terms.
I think that the democratic and representative nature of our organization means that if you're active in it, and if the board knows how you feel, they're going to hopefully vote with you.
I think it's great that we're looking at ways to restructure debt if it's going to...
We have 230 people who work here. Most of them are owners. People in their first couple months here are probationary members.
Motion passes unanimously.
There's no type of work done here that isn't part of our membership.
41, where are you?
It just seems like a modern way to run a company, to respect the incredible amount of knowledge that everybody around us has and to put it to use, to help everyone be decision makers.
10-4.
I don't know why I would think that I'm supposed to make more than I'm making. I don't know why I would think that way. I don't. I put food on my table, and I hope everyone at Union Cab does. That's really the intention, is to provide a living wage for everyone. It's as American as I can imagine.
We're capitalists, and we're so sucked into personal security and personal income and personal profit at the expense of others and competition in a way that the rest of the world just isn't. Like, why does anyone need more than $300,000 a year to live on? Why? Earning profits is not our primary purpose. Our primary purpose is to create jobs. And we're focusing on creating an alternative so that when the system, the financial system, collapses, there will be already an alternative in place for people to look at. We could even have jobs without money. For the 200,000 years that human beings have been on this planet, we've worked. Money has only been in existence for about 10,000 years. Our cooperative structure sort of helps us get away from this addiction to money and addiction to thinking that profits are the be-all and end-all of life. I mean, money is not the life force. Life is the life force. Human creativity is our life force.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Buildingbridgesradio.org.